Kika's Corner. My name is Kika Matos and I'm your host. On this show, we look at our community, our city, and the world, and always, always, always we do it through a social justice lens. A few months ago, I hosted Jacob Padron on this show. Recall Jacob is the new artistic director of the Long Wharf Theater. During the show, he shared his artistic vision for the Long Wharf Theater, including his desire to create a space that elevates the voices of people of color, embraces community, and tells the kinds of stories that for too long have been neglected by traditional theater. Today, we have a playwright on the show, one whose work is about to premiere at the Long Wharf Theater. His name is Ricardo Perez Gonzalez. Let me say a little bit about Ricardo. He describes himself as a queer Latine writer with bacalao on his breath and salsa on his hips. For those of you who are listening, bacalao is Spanish for codfish, which is a staple in traditional Puerto Rican cooking. Ricardo's not just a playwright. He also writes for television. Let me quickly share with you some, but not all of his work. As a playwright, his first work was the story of the World War I Christmas truce called In Fields Where They Lay, which got rave reviews from the New York Times. Additional writing credits include the drag ball musical Neon Baby, Ashe, which is a Puerto Rican-style two brothers myths that involves Santeria, and La Casa de Ocasio, or Ocasio's House, which is a transgender family drama. And to all of you Netflix fans out there, Ricardo just finished writing for the third season of Designated Survivor. Ricardo, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Kika.
And welcome to New Haven.
Yes, it's a delight to be here.
Now, you're not new to New Haven. You shared your history in the city.
Yes, indeed. My partner, Ron Carlos, used to teach at the Yale School of Drama. So he was out here every week teaching, and I would come out frequently. And indeed, over the 5 years that he taught there, we bought a house here, and we have been part of a community since.
And where's your house? What neighborhood?
New Hallville.
Oh, yeah. Very cool.
We got a little Puerto Rican block, and we're starting to move in.
And you still have the house?
Yes. We currently are rented out. We've moved to Los Angeles because of my TV writing.
Okay. Now, there is a lot of buzz in the Latine community about your play. Word on the street is that a Puerto Rican playwright wrote the play that's about to premiere at the Long Wharf. Are you from Puerto Rico?
I am. Both my parents are from Puerto Rico. I claim my origin as Puerto Rico. It's part of my origin story, if you will, my origin myth. So I was actually born in a trailer park in Ames, Iowa, and I've lived in Nebraska, Virginia, California, but always a place that was a consistent touchstone in my upbringing was Puerto Rico, going back there for summers, visiting family, and having, you know, my mother is from the Rio Piedras area. My father is from Carolina, El Comandante, just outside of San Juan. And that's always been a piece of who I am. So when people ask me if I'm from Puerto Rico, I say yes, but I am not physically, I was not physically born. It's the old phrase, what is it? Borincano, aunque naciera en la luna, right? Mm-hmm. Puerto Rican, even if you're born on the moon.
Yeah, amen to that. I actually, when I was preparing for the show yesterday, I Googled Puerto Rican playwrights and found a Wikipedia page that listed a total of 15 playwrights and realizes a real dearth of Puerto Rican storytelling. Why did you decide to become a playwright?
It's a really good question. It has to do with that exact, what you just kind of pointed out, a dearth of voices. I started off as an actor. And I loved it. It was very much a part of who I was and who I am. I still act on occasion. And I noticed there was a real dearth of stories for brown folk, frankly, mm-hmm. Puerto Ricans, Latine folk, people of color in general, and also queer folk.
Yeah.
So I just remember preparing for so many auditions and friends talking about if I was too femme or too butch or too queer presenting.
Wow.
On occasion, and that being kind of cannon fodder for whether or not I would get a role. And also just, I was sent out for so many, street thugs and drug dealers and servant parts. And there's nothing wrong with that. I do not think, as a storyteller and as a Latina storyteller, I never want to denigrate the dignity of all of our gente, you know, mm-hmm. in all of our complexity, whether we are indeed engaged in what people consider illicit activities, but are now making California money to the tune of millions of dollars when you're talking about, say, weed,
yeah.
which is, you know, you see all the funny Latino stereotypes of weed smoking Mexican folk,
mm-hmm.
and now corporations are profiting off of it, yeah. right? So I think there is great dignity in even Latino stories of criminal folk or people who have been criminalized, I should say, and people who are in the service industry. But as an actor, I those weren't the roles that I was getting.
Okay.
So as I was out there as an actor facing that reality, I decided there needed to be more stories for us mm-hmm. out there. More stories that represented us, represented us in all our complexities and from our point of view. And also, I love history and voices that have disappeared in history, voices that have been silenced in history, because black and brown folk have been here forever.
Yeah.
And when you go to history class in the U.S., it's as if the world was created by Europeans.
Right.
And again, I will never denigrate or dismiss the accomplishments of Europeans, but we have been here since the start, and we have built so much of this country, so much of our history, so much of culture, and Africa has been a seat for that. Indigenous people have been a source, a fuente for that. So there's, why don't we hear those stories? Mm-hmm. And I'm passionate about putting those on stage in my plays.
Your plays have explored themes that are not always embraced by traditional theater. You've written about drag. You've written about Puerto Rican Santeria.
Mm-hmm.
You've written about a transgender family. And your upcoming play that's going to premiere at the Long Wharf is about a biracial gay couple in Texas in the 1950s. I mean, you talked a little bit about what has compelled you to tell these stories, but how, I mean, it's such a broad brush of stories.
Mm-hmm.
How do you come up with these stories? What compels you and inspires you, particularly the stories and the play about World War One and soldiers making peace during Christmas? What drives you to tell these stories, and how does your mind work?
Well, that's a really wonderful question. I will refer you to my partner. He probably has some fun little anecdotes about my mind, how my mind does or does not work, as he might say sometimes. But for me, really the overarching theme in my stories are about these unknown voices, unknown stories that we tend to overlook. And I also have this kind of very hopeful view, and I gravitate towards stories that are born out of struggle and strife, but have these moments of hope. I also, I'm indebted to many people in my lives for bringing me these stories. Brad Raimondo was the director of the In Fields Where They Lay, this play about the World War One Christmas truce. And he actually came to me with the idea and wanted to do it when I was an actor. He wanted to devise something and I would have participated as an actor. And I looked at him and I said, no, let me write it. Wow. I was so drawn to this moment in time, this moment in the war that has defined the last century,
mm-hmm.
really, that has defined what modern day warfare looks like and broke the globe apart in a way that we are still feeling the repercussions of. And in the moment of that, there was a moment where it could have all stopped, where ordinary folk on both sides lay down their arms and said, I'm not going to shoot you. It's Christmas.
Right.
And they had to be rotated out in some cases along the Western Front. And this wasn't something that came from on high. This wasn't something that the top brass implemented. This was something ordinary people implemented. They decided from the bottom up that this wasn't going to happen. And I live in a world sometimes where I can't stop imagining the possibility of what could have been had people decided at crucial points to lay down their arms and embrace each other as gente, as brother, as familia. And that's a world I want to live in. So yeah. In my imagination, that's what I imagine. That's what I conjure in terms of playwriting. And that's what I try to invoke on the stage, a space where we can imagine that shared and beautiful world while still recognizing the mierda that we wade through, the conflict and the vicious and oppressive structures we have built and inflict upon each other. Those two things exist simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And someday, I believe, we'll get there. We're not there.
Regardless of president. Is it hard to get these stories on stage?
Oh, yeah. It really takes a visionary like Jacob Padrón and a wonderful director, somebody like David Mendizábal, who's my director on this and on other projects, to really advocate for you. Because first off, there is a real hunger, I do believe, now for kind of authentic and raw storytelling. So there is a greater demand for stories of color, queer stories. But the margin is very narrow. So I still think theaters often think they can have the one every 5 years,
right,
you know?
The token one.
Yeah, the token one. That's still kind of a mentality like, well, we have the one this season, so we can't have more than that. I also think there's a desire for torture porn or poverty porn or victim porn, where it's we see people of color being oppressed and not much hope, and non-people of color get to see that and feel as if they have had an experience. And again, I do not wish to denigrate plays of those ilk, because for me, it's about multiplicity of voices. Mm-hmm. If those plays existed along with plays of empowered people of color existing in spaces where they are centered, that would be a different story. You see that, you know, there's a wonderful play that the Movement Theater Company is doing, What to Send Up When It Goes Down, that really centers blackness in terms of all of the violence that's going on. And if plays like that were being produced left and right at theaters across the country, I think it would be a different conversation. But because my work is both about people of color and queer, it gives people more incentive to say, I don't know about that. That's not our target audience. And it also is somewhat incessantly hopeful. And that can be not what everybody wants in this day and age, which seems really counterintuitive to me. But I think it is a part of what my quote-unquote struggle is around that.
And despite the challenges, you are pretty courageous and tenacious about fulfilling your vision.
Thank you.
I want to talk a little bit about the play that's going to premiere, I believe, this Wednesday at the Long Wharf.
First performance, Wednesday. Yes.
That's really exciting. On the Grounds of Belonging is the name of the play, and it's a love story set during the Jim Crow days when laws were also in place that barred sexual activity between consulting adults of the same sex. And I just want to note, again, when I was preparing for this interview, I was really struck by the fact that the anti-sodomy laws in Texas were not struck down until 2003. That was...
Lawrence v. Texas.
Yeah. So tell us how this story came to you. Is it based on a real life story or...
Yes and no.
Okay.
So I like to say that this story begins like all good stories begin, all romances begin with a boy. It is itself comes out of a romance. I was dating somebody in Los Angeles many years back, and he had some older friends, his elder queers, if you were actually from Houston, Texas, and went to the racially segregated gay bars in which the play is set.
Okay.
So the Red Room and the Gold Room. And this gentleman's elders went to the Gold Room, the blacks only bar in Houston. And they would tell stories of how they would try to sneak into the Red Room, the whites only bar, and how one of them had relationships with white men and the complications around that, what it meant and what both of their different, it was Michael Melton and this gentleman, Stanley, and they've had very different points of view on those relationships. And when I heard this story from my lover at the time, my first thought was, oh, there were racially segregated gay bars. Well, that makes sense. Queer people are not immune to the oppressive
racism,
structures. Yeah, to racism and the oppressive structures society has built, right? And then my second thought was, oh, there were racially segregated gay bars in 1950s Houston, Texas? Well, there still are. When you really think about it. And when I would go out in New York, I'd go to Hell's Kitchen and it really felt like there were whites-only bars.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go up to Washington Heights to no parking and, you know, it was Latine bars, you know, primarily Dominican. And then you go to the Web, which is very much an Asian bar. And, you know, you only need go to Grindr to see whites-only signs still very much alive and existent in our cultural milieu. So I just was really compelled to write this story. And it's not Michael or Stanley's life story. It's not anybody's really word for word what happened. It was inspired by them and an activist, Ray Hill from Houston, a white gentleman who actually did a sit-in to help try to integrate the Red Room. He was part of a kind of a historic sit-in there and has always been a wonderful activist. Rest in peace. And I took little bits and pieces of their stories of Houston and kind of used it to inform this love story, which honestly, I did all this research and I was, you know, getting all these stories and I was writing and writing and writing. And then I wrote the thing and I looked at it and I was like, oh, wait, it's Romeo and Juliet. You know, it's
wow.
And that's not to sell it short. I think it's a very rich, vibrant story. But, you know, it does have a basis in history and the reality of the stories I heard. But it also very much has a connection to archetypal love stories that we all can relate to.
Yeah.
And these romances and these kind of forbidden loves
mm-hmm.
that we all, I think, understand viscerally.
And this is a trilogy, right? So
yes.
What's next? And I'm not going to ask you, I was going to ask for spoiler alert, whether it has a happy ending, but then I realized that's a big spoiler, so I'm not going to ask you.
So no spoilers, but it does follow queer love through the ages. So it follows this love from the 1950s and a version of this love to the 1980s and another version of this love in the present day. So the 1980s in Houston, where the lovers are going through the AIDS epidemic and mm-hmm. what that means, particularly in queer communities of color. And then the present day, where one of the lovers is deciding to end his life with dignity and has to tell his adopted Puerto Rican son that this is going to happen and what that means. So it's about love through the ages. It's about queer folk through the ages. It's about death
mm-hmm.
through the ages. What was death when it was something that was done to us? What was death when it was the waters in which we swam
right.
during the epidemic? And
right.
what is death when it's something we choose for ourselves?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of arc of it all.
And why the Long Wharf?
Several reasons. So because of my relationship to New Haven, I feel very much at home here. Again, Jacob Pedron is a visionary artistic director, and he had a relationship with this play when he worked at the Public Theater in New York. It sprang from the emerging writers group at the Public and was produced as a workshop production, a two-week engagement at the Public Theater, the Public Studio. And so he knew it from there and had the relationship. And I also think it is just an amazing thing. I don't know where this is happening in a regional theater across the country or a major, you know, theater in New York even, where I am a Latina playwright working with a Latina director, David Mendizabal, and a Latina artistic director, Jacob Padron. So it's kind of this wonderful meeting of the three of us in this moment. And I also believe that it's a story for New Haven right now. Just thinking about New Haven's connection to queer history, New Haven's connection to race and mm-hmm. racism and segregation and white flight and that history, it really resonates. And also, I just think we all need a good love story right now.
Do we ever?
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about a few of your upcoming projects. I find the themes again really fascinating, and then I'm going to ask you, related to what you just talked about the role of playwrights during difficult democratic moments or mm-hmm. moments in when our democracy is being tested. But one of the projects that you're working on is a pilot that involves the Puerto Rican community in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria.
Yes, absolutely.
Talk to us. Is this going to be a film?
No, a
play?
So it's a series in development.
Okay.
And as all things in development go, they are in development. And I'm very lucky to be working with the amazing Nina Tassler and her new studio, Patmos Studios, which is very much a new, exciting studio, female-led, female-driven, and visionary. And it's right now it's a TV series, so I'm working on the pilot.
Okay.
And there's, you know, it's in the works, so mm-hmm. I can't say too much about its future or trajectory. But what I will say is that it really deals with a family trying to put itself back together, a single mother who was raising two kids, lost one of them during the Pulse massacre, actually, mm-hmm. in Orlando, and then goes through Maria and has to come back to Orlando and deal with this legacy of trauma. Because right now, I mean, that's when you think about Pulse and then Maria, those were two twin tragedies that mm-hmm. hit the Puerto Rican community in here and in on the island.
Right.
In very deep ways. And how do we recover and rebuild from losses like that?
Yeah.
How do we create our families again?
Mm-hmm.
And that's it's a very exciting, I feel very blessed to be doing that project. And I'm very grateful to Patma and to Nina for giving it voice and life.
That's beautiful. And then you also have another project that I thought would have a lot of resonance with people in New Haven, given how many universities there are here. Mm-hmm. And that's The Judgment of Athena, which involves women academics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's this trifecta of female academics, one being an African-American professor, the other being an Asian-American, a Chinese-American professor, and then their kind of shared Latina intern, if you will, or graduate student. I shouldn't say intern. Her doctorate student they're both kind of mentoring her, and accusations of plagiarism come out, and it's loosely based on a very real academic case. disclaimers. It's loosely based. I'm staring at the door wondering if lawyers are going to bust in, but it really does, for me, it really was about how we emulate power structures, mm-hmm. right? So I don't think there's a white person in the play, and that's, you know, not an aspersion towards anyone, but for me, it's just really about what happens when we as people of color, we as oppressed folk start to play the same game that the kind of white heteropatriarchy has been playing for millennia.
Mm-hmm.
And academia is such a bastion of that. And you look at Yale, and I actually have a lot of love for Yale. Yale has a lot of, especially the School of Drama, has a lot of kind of well-meaning intentions and is trying to really move forward. Just knowing my partner as a professor there, when he was teaching there, particularly the School of Drama is working so hard to be inclusive and really get on the forefront of equity, diversity, and inclusion issues, especially in their recruiting and who they are casting or in, out of their auditions, you know, for their classes, bringing in for their classes. And still at the same time, it is just a bastion. It was not created for us.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so what do you do in that house that was not created for you? And I love, you know, Audre Lorde's quote, the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house.
Yeah.
Sometimes, though, I wonder, you know, are the master's tools the only thing that can, you know? So it's an investigation of that. And it's very much also a play. It's a very nascent play. And I haven't had the space to workshop it or work on it. So it's very interesting and fun to talk about it because it's not one of the pieces that's popping right now. My play, Don't Eat the Mangoes, which is going up under the direction of David Mendizabal in San Francisco, mm-hmm. under the artistic directorship of Loretta Greco, which I'm very grateful for, is, you know, that's popping, the okay. story of three Puerto Rican sisters. But I'm excited to kind of talk about my quote-unquote lesser-known work or lesser-talked-about work.
Are you going to lurk around campuses to see if you'll be inspired?
I already do.
That's awesome.
All you Yalies listening. You don't know it, but I'm sitting right behind you.
Right. If any Yalies listening have felt paranoid, you were justified in feeling paranoid.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not paranoia because...
yeah. You know, Ricardo, I'm really struck by the fact that you are not afraid to challenge convention and tackle really difficult issues and tell stories that very few people are telling, but you do it with such love and such a sense of optimism. I want to ask you about the moments that we are living in. We live now in a country where racism is rampant. There's a lot of racial violence. This administration has gone after immigrants relentlessly. Mm-hmm. You know, there's talks now about impeachment. I wonder what you think the role of playwrights and folks in the arts is during a time when I think our democracy is being challenged like never before in my lifetime.
Absolutely. So I do think first and foremost, it is to tell the story, right? So we are living in a time of great pain and difficulty. And I think we can't shy away from looking into that pain and creating something from it. And really telling the stories of those who are most vulnerable and most impacted. At this moment in time, stories of folk in power are not, unless they're shattering some great, unless they're really uncovering something new, I'm not so interested in that. I really think we have to uplift the voices of those who are being hardest hit so that we can reflect those stories. I do think, in addition to that, just because I think we're kind of being subjected to something of a psychological terrorist attack, and I think that this is the same, it's the same attack that Black folk and Indigenous folk have actually been undergoing since the inception of this nation, right? This nation, this notion that you are not a person, you do not belong, right. You do not have rights. It is an ongoing act of terrorism, emotional and psychological terrorism, and physical, let's be real. So I think as an artist, it is incumbent upon me to uplift and glorify our personhood and the reminder of our humanity and our shared humanity. And I think that it's, you know, on the grounds of belonging is very much about segregation specifically between white folk and Black folk, Black Americans and white Americans. And at the same time, I fully want to, I think it resonates for Latino folk because we have our own issues with colorism. I think it resonates for straight folk because obviously, you know, love stories aren't just limited to who you love. And I also think, you know, there's a tendency to kind of see, and this is where the kind of victimhood porn or torture porn, if you will, comes into it, where we see person of color or oppressed person as victim. And on the grounds of belonging, and I think all work should, also show how white folk are incredibly damaged by this dynamic, how racism strips us all of our humanity and robs us all of the opportunity for love. So we have to ask the question, what do you have to do to make love possible? What do you have to do to make this hope possible? I think because we're so bombarded with stories of denigration and stories of violence on our Facebook feed, I do think artists need to be aware that just putting that up on stage again and again and again isn't actually adding to the conversation. So how do we honor that reality and still show, reach out to those who are some, honestly, after Charleston, I was afraid to leave my bed for 2 days. And I'm a very light-skinned Puerto Rican. So that's another thing artists have to do is recognize your social position.
Yeah.
And whether you are a person of color or not, whether you are queer or not, what is that? There's a whole rainbow and spectrum we have to grapple with. But, you know, going back to after the events there, I just couldn't leave. And I'm very much an activist. Mm-hmm. I write letters. I call my congressfolk. I door knock. I have knocked on doors since the Obama campaign, since the first Obama campaign. I knocked for Hillary. I will knock for, let's hope it's Elizabeth, or whoever, honestly, whoever the Democratic candidate is, I will knock on doors for them, and I hope you will join me. So I was paralyzed with this onslaught of violence. And I think it's important that we remember there are still people who are still in their beds and can't move because of what's going on in this nation.
You're listening to Kika's Corner on WNHHLP 103.5 FM, broadcasting live from downtown New Haven. We're streaming live on TuneIn Radio and newhavenindependent.org. We're also streaming live on Facebook Live. Just go to facebook.com/ New Haven Independent, or just go to your Facebook page and look us up. Unfortunately, we are coming to the end of the show, and it's my practice with my guests to get a little personal. So, Ricardo, are you ready?
Yes.
Who is your shiro or hero?
Oh, that's so old school, like when I was a little kid, it was Harriet Tubman. Because, I mean, come on, like,
I love her.
How can you not?
Yeah.
How can anybody not, like, just hear her story and think, that is badass?
Yeah.
Like, man.
If you could have any superpower, what would it be?
Ooh, the first one that comes to mind is walking through walls. Because, man, just how cool would that just be to, like, appear out of nowhere? With flying coming in a second, you know, close second, because who wouldn't want to fly, you know?
I have never heard of walking through walls. That one's really cool. Sally's, Pepe's, or Modern Pizza?
Oh, Moderna, right? Like, Modern Pizza, I guess.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like I'm going to get in trouble for that, but yes.
So Modern Pizza is your pizza,
yeah. So good. So good.
I'm with you. I'm a Modern Pizza fan.
Yeah.
Folks, that brings us to the end of our show. Thank you for listening. And Ricardo, thank you for being on the show. For those of you who are listening, On the Grounds of Belonging premieres this Wednesday, October 9, at the Long Wharf Theater, and it runs through November the 3rd. So people, please go see it. Until next time, here is wishing for more justice in the world and many, many days of sunshine.